Okay, we're going to try and talk a little this evening about Nostradamus and the Bible, fulfilled prophecy. Obviously, there's considerable interest in the future all through human history. More today in some ways, I suppose. There are prophets who are going to make predictions every year. I know some of the what we might call grocery store newspapers typically have predictions of half a dozen of these prophets at the beginning of the year. Sometimes you never hear anything about their predictions later because they bomb rather badly. But there certainly is considerable claim floating around to be able to make predictions regarding the future. We want to examine, as I suggest here, two of the strongest claims that I have seen, and that's the claim of Nostradamus and the claim of the Bible. So that will be our topic this evening. Let's think a little bit about Nostradamus. First of all, that's the Latin version of his name, Michael de Notre Dame, born in 1503, died in 1566. He was a physician, but dabbled in astrology and Jewish background, but Roman Catholic in his theology, at least as regards his profession. He was trained, as I mentioned, in philosophy and medicine as well. Began to make prophecies late in his life, 1547, and these eventually issued in a book called The Centuries. The name does not, as you might immediately think, say I'm talking about the centuries to come, although in fact that's what he's doing. But he constructed his prophecies in the form of quatrains, four-line poems, and divided those up into centuries, into hundreds of four-line poems, and had nearly 1,000 of them. First edition was published in 1555, and he revised that, extended that, expanded that somewhat in his second edition in 1558, and that's how he left it then when he died. Bible has a range of authors, some argument over just how many. The dates of the authorship might even go back before 1500 BC, depending on what you do with Job, or depending also on whether you think the book of Genesis was written piecemeal by the patriarchs and then collected or finalized by Moses, as a number of evangelicals have suggested, or whether you think that it arose pretty directly by revelation to Moses around 1500 or something of that sort. The last book of the scripture written was the Revelation to John, and that's just before 100 A.D. The authors of the Bible claim to be speaking for the creator of the universe, the one who knows the end from the beginning, who cannot lie, and who has concern to reveal himself to mankind, and who also, by the way, uses prophecy as an evidence that these writers of scripture really are from him and are not merely charlatans. So that a rather important feature. The Bible obviously is connected with Moses, the one who, in some sense, is the founder of the nation of Israel. Abraham, obviously, regarding genealogy, but Moses is regarding the people. With David, one who becomes its famous king, and then with Jesus, certainly a person that even many atheists would agree is one of the major figures of human history. The prophecies already begin in Genesis and run all the way out to Revelation, although prophecies obviously occur in a greater amount in some books and lesser amount in others. What we want to do is we want to look at four prophecies from each of these sources, from Nostradamus and from the Bible. We want to engage in what we hear in seminary called exegesis, attempting to read out of the passages what is there, attempting to deal with and think through the context at the time they were written and such, and see what we've got in the way of predictions. Now, one of the things you run into immediately with Nostradamus is that his quatrains don't seem to have much relation to one another. That is, there's no context to work with. Many of your Nostradamus guys will, however, take quatrains that appear to be referring to the same thing and group them together and try and think about them in that way, but they don't appear to have been grouped that way by Nostradamus. Secondly, Nostradamus speaks in very much a riddling fashion, a mysterious way of speaking, and it is very, I would say, invariably difficult to tell what he's talking about most of the time. That will obviously have some influence on figuring out what he's doing. This is the first one we won't look at, and one of the really striking ones, it's clearly talking about a fire of London found in century 2 of Nostradamus and quatrain 51. That's what the numbers will be here on each of these. And it reads, "The blood of the just will make complaint to London, burnt by fireballs in 23 the sixes. The antique dame will fall from the high place. Of the same sect, many will be destroyed." Well, before we jump into that much, it sounds like London has done something wrong and will be avenged, that is, people whom they have mistreated, presumably people whose blood they have shed, will be avenged on London by London being burnt. If I were reading this by itself without any knowledge of history, I would be inclined to think that we would have ball lightning or some kind of fireballs falling from the sky or some kind of fireballs rising from the ground or something of that sort. We have no knowledge of anything of that sort happening. But the passage is quite clear that there's a fire in London, and it sounds like the second line is giving something about the time in which this will occur. 23 the sixes. And then one would presume the last two lines are telling us something about the consequences of this. The antique dame will fall from the high place. Of the same sect, many will be destroyed. Antique dame, probably reading this here, would suspect an old lady, maybe a queen. But then you've got the remark, of the same sect, many will be destroyed. And that perhaps suggests that there's something religious, perhaps, going on here. Well, what do we find? What kind of fulfillment do we find? Well, if you think about it, there is one fire of London which is more famous than any of the others. That's the fire of London in 1666. Well, certainly, the sixes would not be a bad way of speaking of 1666. Certainly, the number with the most sixes of any date that has occurred since the time of Nostradamus, and will match any of them up until we get to the year 6666, which is quite a long distance off in the future and way beyond anything that Nostradamus makes any direct allusions to, which only go a little past the year 2000. So that's not bad. Some kind of a riddling way of speaking of it, but not unfair. What are you to make of 23 the sixes? I could not find any commentators that knew. I fiddled around a little bit, though, and looked in Encyclopedia Britannica and said, when did the fire of 1666 take place? And it turns out it took place in September, on the 2nd, 3rd, 4th, and 5th of September. Now, if you take the 9th month, September, and add that to 2 and 3 and 4 and 5, you get 23. Fluke? I don't know. There it is. Okay. There's nothing in the passage that tells you should count September as the 9th month. And in fact, in 1555, when the first edition came out, September was probably not considered the 9th month. It was probably considered the 7th month, as in fact its name says. September, October, 10th month, November, 11th month, December, 12th month, 10th month. And you say, November, 9th month. You say, how do you get 12 months in a year that way? Well, January and February were the 11th and 12th months, because up until the 1700s, it was common to view the beginning of the year as in March rather than in December. Not sure what to make of that, but in fact, this does work. And I got the numbers for the length of the fire from the Encyclopedia Britannica, not from a Nostradamus commentator. Oh, well, rather interesting. He speaks of something that's happening in the sixes, and it's clearly a fire of London, and the biggest fire of London is 1666. And he calls it 23 the sixes, and here at least is a way to read 23 that works. What do you do with the fireballs? I can't think of anything to do with the fireballs. I don't know of any accounts of the fire of London that suggested balls of fire were coming out from anywhere, so don't know what to tell you about that. It's the antique dame. The Nostradamus commentators typically say that's a reference to St. Paul's Cathedral, which burnt down in the Fire of London, because St. Paul's was built on a traditional site of a pagan temple, the Diana, going back to ancient London in the Greco-Roman period, hard to know what to make of that. That certainly is not obvious, and not at all clear whether that's what he had in mind. Though, if you go this way, then others of the same sect would probably be other Anglican churches. And Nostradamus, as a Roman Catholic, might be very well expected to speak of the Anglicans as a sect. So that is at least not unreasonable. And so other Anglican churches burnt. So in fact, there is a interpretation of this Nostradamus quatrain that looks pretty impressive. There has been a fire in London. There have been several, of course. The fire of London is in the sixes, if you like. 23 could be applied to it in the way I suggest here, and we could do this with the antique dame and the others of the same sect.
Did he write in French?
He wrote in Provençal French, and I've got a text up here in my briefcase that has the French on one page and the English on the facing, English translation on the facing page. Interestingly, the guy who did this, I'll give you a bibliography here at the end and a sketch of the text of these various ones, not the French of them. The guy who did that actually did not translate our passage quite the way I did, but at least for the sixes, I think the translation I gave is closer to the French than the translation he did, which was just the six. But the definite article on the word six is clearly a plural and not a singular. Biblical example, rather interesting one, comes out of Hosea. It's in some sense the climax of the acted parable that dominates Hosea chapters 1, 2, and 3. Hosea was called upon by God to marry a woman who was known to be unfaithful. And the reason he was called upon to do that, which certainly God would not encourage in general, is that it was to be a acted parable of the relationship between God and Israel. God chose Israel to be his wife, though he knew she was unfaithful. And so they're married, and children begin to come, and there might be some argument whether these children are necessarily Hosea's children or not. They're certainly Gomer's children, his wife. And eventually she runs off. And then Hosea is told at the beginning of chapter 3 to go and bring her back. And most commentators think he buys her out of slavery, although one friend of mine who's worked through the passage thinks maybe we're talking buying her services as prostitute, but for enough money that she will stay with him many days. But his relationship to her will no longer be that of husband to wife. That is, they will not have sexual relations during this period, because their relation during this period is to be a picture of the relationship between God and Israel for a period. And that period is explained here in Hosea chapter 3, verses 4 and 5. For the sons of Israel will remain for many days without king or prince, without sacrifice or sacred pillar, without ephod or household idols. Afterward, the sons of Israel will return and seek the Lord their God and David their king, and they will come trembling to the Lord and to his goodness in the last days. A picture here then of what? Israel without certain things for many days. Many days in terms of Hosea's marriage might be hundreds of days or a few years or something of that sort. Many days on the much bigger scale of the nation of Israel might be for many centuries or something. Doesn't tell you how big a period it would be. They'll be lacking six things, and they look like they come in pairs. King prince, sacrifice sacred pillar, ephod household idols. There are a couple of ways to construe these, but probably the simplest one is to suggest that the first item in each pair is something God provided under his covenant, and the second item in each pair is the direction that Israel tended to head off into in their idolatrous activity. So they'll remain for a long time without a Davidic king, but they won't have even a prince. And the word prince in English, of course, has the idea of royalty or something. The word prince in Hebrew just has the idea of government official. So they'll be a long time without a king or even a government official. They'll be without sacrifice established by God in the Mosaic Covenant, though obviously done earlier than that. But they'll also be without the sacred pillar. And on the scheme we're looking at here, that'd probably mean Canaanite pillar worship type things involved with the Ashtoreth and such. And then ephod, the sort of vest thing that the high priest wore, and household idol, turning away from God. So it would seem to suggest that Israel will be for many days without six things, three of which are revealed features of their covenant, and the other three are the tendencies that they had often been going into at Hosea's time. Then there's going to be an afterward. Something better is going to happen after that. But in the many days that were pictured here, seems to be a limbo of some sort. without Sinai religion, and yet without idolatry. And then there'll come an afterward in which the Israelites will return to the Lord. They'll seek him. They'll seek David, their king. Messianic, or it may be referring literally to David. They'll come trembling to the Lord in his goodness, and that seems to be eschatological in the last days, seems to be the picture that we see going on there. Well, what has happened? Six things Israel will lack for many days. King and prince. King or prince. Perhaps the way to read this, they'll have neither revealed government nor their own government. That, in fact, is a good fit for the status of Israel from 70 AD till 1948. Their nation was destroyed. They did not have any Davidic kings, didn't even have any non-Davidic Jewish kings, and in fact had no rulers of their own up until 1948 when they reestablished their nation. Rather interesting, two features that have characterized Israel all that period, though in fact they were supposed to have a Davidic king. In fact, a Davidic king in some sense was supposed to rule forever. And see some ways in which that works out in connection with the Messiah. Sacrifice nor pillar, neither Sinai religion nor, as I said before, idolatry, ephod, teraphim. That's a very interesting feature. Israel had typically been characterized for several hundred years by Hosea's time as always drifting off into idolatry, Canaanite idolatry or idolatry of some of the other nations around them. But the Babylonian captivity in some sense seems to have cured them of idolatry, at least in any literal sense. And yet they still continue to have Sinai religion all the way up till 70 AD with the destruction of the temple. Since 70 AD, all the way to this time, they have had neither Sinai religion nor idolatry in any narrow sense. I mean, there's obviously some sense in which you can argue that some Jews have made idolatry out of money or things of that sort, certainly. But the nation, characterized as a whole, has not fallen into that particular problem. So they have lacked all of these from about 70 AD to 1948, and they still lack all of them except the prince, understood as a government official. Afterward, they will turn to the Lord their God and to David their king. We see something happening in our century. We cannot tell how close we are to the last days, but an unprecedented turning of Jews to Jesus. Actually, not just in the century, though it has been that, actually perhaps in the last 40 or 50 years, there has been an unusual turning there, though certainly no huge groundswell by any means even yet. So, one sample from Nostradamus, one from the Bible. We learn to turn to another of Nostradamus' quatrains out of century 8, quatrain 1, Pau ne loron will be more fire than blood, to swim in praise, the great one to flee on the confluence of waters. He will refuse the Agassus entry, great bridge durance, he will hold them imprisoned. What is that about? Sounds like an individual. More fire than blood. Kills people with fire instead of shedding their blood. That's not the suggestion that the commentators typically make. To swim in praise certainly sounds like the person will be very highly exalted. The great one to flee on the confluence of waters. If the great one is the same person, then on the one hand there will be great praise, on the other hand the person will need to run away. He will refuse the Agassus entry. Who are they? What entry is he refusing them, etc.? Great bridge durance, he will hold them in prison. You're working with poetry here, and this is an attempt to represent it in English, which isn't following the details of the poetry, but it sounds like that who presumably this Paul ne loron is going to hold the Agassus imprisoned, and perhaps the great bridge durance is where it's going to happen. Well, suggestion of your Nostradamus commentators as we're looking at Napoleon, and Pau ne loron is an anagram for Roy Napoleon, King Napoleon. Be vaguely over in that direction, okay? What else could you make of it? You know, if you assume that this is Napoleon, then that will work. It's certainly not terribly obvious. It's not a perfect anagram by any means. Spelling is certainly not too promising. More fire than blood, a suggestion. More soldier than nobleman. Certainly blood has been used throughout history, particularly previous centuries, as born of noble blood, that sort of thing. So that's possible. Fire might be soldier, although you can see fire might mean a person who has great rhetorical skills or a person who has a certain kind of personality or something of that sort. So that's possible, but hardly demanding by any means. Flee on the waters. Flight from Elba. Elba is the island out in one of the islands out in the Mediterranean that Napoleon was imprisoned on after he first lost power. And he was able to flee from there, although he wasn't running away. He was running away from his imprisonment and came back to France and was able to raise an army. And his major battle of Waterloo was, in fact, fought after that. I don't think that runs very close along the direction that the wording goes, but that is the suggestion which has been made here. What about the Agossis? It's been pointed out that Agossis is the word in Provençal French, Provençal French, for a magpie, which the normal word in French is P-I-E. I have no idea how that's pronounced. I'm not a French-type person, which turns out to be also the way the name Pius, that is used for many of the popes, is spelled in French. So the suggestion is that this is Napoleon holding imprisoned the two popes, Pius VI and VII, which indeed he did. Great Bridge Durance, well, the River Durance is in South France, though in fact he did not imprison them at any place where there's a river bridge over the River Durance or anything. So that is only a rather general type of statement that we have there. So the Napoleon one is rather less impressive than the Fire of London one was. Perhaps the most impressive thing is that the Palme-Lauron can be worked into an anagram for King Napoleon with rough spelling, and that the Agossis can be made. It's obviously two or more individuals which are being held imprisoned. That's fair, I think, from the passage. And perhaps some play on the word pious, which would be impressive, though it's moderately remote, as you can see. Turn back to the Bible for a sample. A rather famous passage in Daniel chapter 9 of Daniel's 70 weeks. Daniel, at the beginning of chapter 9, has come to realize that there's a prediction in the prophet Jeremiah that the captivity of Israel will last 70 years, and that 70 years must be near up, obviously with a slight complication of trying to decide exactly when it started, because Israel was carried off in several pieces, several different deportations and such. And so Daniel begins to pray to the Lord, and he begins to confess his sins and the sins of his forefathers and the sins of the nation, etc. And as he has been praying that for a while, an angel appears to him and gives him a message. And that message, I don't have the whole thing here, but the front part of it is this: know and discern that from the issuing of a decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until the Messiah the Prince, there will be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. It will be built again with plaza and moat, even in times of distress. Then after the 62 weeks, the Messiah will be cut off and have nothing. What's going on here? The angel is giving a prophecy that involves weeks. The word used there is a little different from the standard word that is used in the Old Testament for weeks of days. Some have suggested it is perhaps the word that is used for weeks of years. There seems to be some support from the Qumran literature for that, although that's many centuries after the time of Daniel. Making the plural the way it is in Daniel seems to be parallel to making a plural the way it is in the Qumran literature for the sabbatical land use cycle. The Israelites were commanded in the law to set aside 1 year out of seven, a particular year, for all of their property in which all of their agricultural land would lie fallow. And so 6 years they worked the land, and 1 year the land was to rest. So it's a little bit like our crop rotation today, except our procedure is to rotate, certain plots are out of use 1 year, but other plots are in use, and then some others are out of use another year, etc. But this, all the stuff was out of use for one particular year out of seven. The Israelites do not appear to have obeyed that very regularly. And one of the warnings which they received was, again, I think in Leviticus, that if they did not, God would throw them out of the land because of their disobedience. The book of Chronicles ends with a remark suggesting that the 70-year captivity of Israel was to make up for 70 sabbatical years that they did not keep this commandment. And so if we understand that as... whether or not Daniel knew that, we understand that as something that God and the angel knew about, then we may be suggesting here that just as there were those seven, just as there were those 70 sevens of years in which the Israelites did not rest their land, so there are now going to be a future 70 sevens of years in which God will do certain things. What will he do? There are some things mentioned ahead of this he will do, which we'll not get into here, that are some interest. The 70 is going to start with a decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem. And from then until the Messiah, the Prince, comes, if we punctuate it the way we have here, there will be a period of 7 weeks and 62 weeks, that is 69 weeks. It says of that particular time that Jerusalem will be built again. Some have suggested that's what the 7 weeks are about. The first 49 years will be the rebuilding of Jerusalem. And then you have a 62-week period that follows that, which ends with the Messiah being cut off and having nothing. Nothing. Cut off is a fairly standard Jewish use for being put to death, and usually means being judicially put to death. And so that basically seems to be the picture we have here. Fulfillment. There have been several ways in which fulfillments have been suggested for this. Most Christians have understood that the cutting off of the Messiah has to do with the death of Jesus. Been some disagreement on where to start it and what unit of measurement to use and such. The proposed life suggested is that the unit of measurement is Sabbath year cycles. That is, these seven-year periods. And using it as the unit of measurement means that you may have fractional units on either end of your measurement. In Jewish usage, the day on which an event happened is the first day, the next day is the second day, next day is the third day, etc. And so Jesus can rise on the third day and be crucified on Friday, that is the first day. The next day starts at sunset Friday and runs to sunset Saturday, that's the second day. And the next day starts sunset Saturday and runs to sunset Sunday, and he rises on the third day, sometime probably around sunrise or a little before on Sunday. So that basically would be the technique. So unit of measurement, Sabbath year cycles. The best starting point, although there's argument over this, the best starting point is the 20th year of Artaxerxes I, because in Nehemiah chapter 2, we understand that that is when the city's walls are rebuilt. And in Jewish thought, in Middle Eastern thought, typically a place was not a city unless it had fortified walls. And so this rebuilds the city by putting the walls up. If you take 445 BC then to be the starting point, that falls typically in the middle of a sabbatical cycle. We are able to locate those in antiquity with pretty good certainty based on some of the references in various ancient writings. A couple of articles around that deal with that in some detail. I suggested the method of counting is inclusive. That seems to be the standard Jewish thing, that the unit of measurement on which the event occurs, the starting event occurs, is the first of the items, the first of the units, and then you count second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, etc. And the end, then, if you say Jesus was raised on the third day, you can see the terminology there. But you also have in the New Testament, Jesus was raised after 3 days. And obviously, it's not after the third day is over, because the other passages say on the third day. It means after the third day started is after 3 days. Well, if you use that technique, the 69th week is AD 28 to 35 AD, and that, lo and behold, is the period in which Jesus' public ministry took place and in which he was cut off. Spans the ministry of Jesus, and Jesus is cut off. So a rather striking phenomenon in this particular prophecy. At a distance that even liberals would grant is at least 200 years away, you have a statement that marks the cutting off of the Messiah, and that happens to fall at the time of the death of Jesus, the only messianic claimant in Israel that has ever started a world religion of Gentiles. Go back to a third Nostradamus passage, one which is thought by many to refer to Hitler. Liberty will not be recovered. A bold, black, base-born, iniquitous man will occupy it. When the material of the bridge is completed, the Republic of Venice, will be annoyed by Hister. What's going on here? Well, without much context, hard to tell. Some problem of liberty, referring to liberty of France, that might very well be. Nostradamus is, after all, French. And if you read enough of his quatrains, you can see that they are certainly rather French-centered and Europe-centered and such, so that's straightforward. Apparently, a so-and-so man will occupy it, may suggest that he will either occupy liberty or perhaps occupy it, France. Okay? Well, that would fit well. Liberty will not be recovered. This guy will occupy France. Okay? Bold. Anyone who could occupy France, take France, would probably be fairly bold. Black, we would certainly think in our century that would refer to a person of African descent or Indian descent. Base-born, not a nobleman. Iniquitous, wicked. Okay? To get black to work with Hitler, you would have to work in terms of terminology that in fact is used in Europe, was used in Europe some centuries ago, and that is when they talked about somebody being black, they might mean dark complexion rather than black skin, or they might refer to somebody with black hair. And so that kind of thing could hurt, or work all right. Well, bold, black, base-born, iniquitous would all work all right with Hitler if you take black in that particular sense. When the material of the bridge is completed, the Republic of Venice will be annoyed by Hister. Bridge over something, and presumably when it's finished, his troops will march across and bother the Republic of Venice. Of course, there is no Republic of Venice at Hitler's time, so the commentators would say, well, what is the descendant of the Republic of Venice? Italy, or something of that sort. So, idea perhaps of an invasion of Italy. What's this Hister? Well, that's actually one of the reasons they think this is about Hitler. Hister is actually an old name for the Danube River. And so it's quite possible that that's being literally referred to in that particular passage. The suggestion by the commentators is it's an anagram for Hitler, which is not terribly far off of. Though, again, it's not a perfect anagram. So you've got that complication arising again. Someone suggested a pontoon bridge over the Danube in February 1941. I'm not aware of any period at that time in which Hitler was invading Italy. He does invade Italy later when Mussolini is overthrown, but that is later than 41. So complication there, I think, is that does not look very promising. That runs you into one problem that you run into again and again with the Nostradamus material. Sometimes you can find a very impressive fulfillment for one of the four lines in a quatrain, but often get into a mess trying to do anything with some of the others. It's a little bit like preachers trying to get 4 points in their sermon to come out with P, and three of them work well, and they really have to beat on and twist the other thing to get the fourth one to work out. I think you run into a problem with that with the Nostradamus materials. Look at a passage, a third passage here now from the biblical material, and that is the material on the Messiah's burial and resurrection, or the burial and resurrection of the suffering servant. The whole passage from Isaiah 52:12 to 53:13 is very impressive. 52:13 to 53:12, get the right verse numbers on there. I want to look, however, at this particular passage. By oppression and judgment he was taken away. This suffering servant that is pictured in Isaiah 40 through 53 is taken away by oppression and judgment. Mistreated, but the mistreatment sounds judicial. As for his generation, complications of what to do with the word generation, who considered that he was cut off out of the land of the living for the transgression of my people to whom the stroke was due? This person is cut off. Reminds us a little of the Daniel passage. Out of the land of the living makes it clear that we're talking about a death. So by oppression and judgment, he was taken away. He's taken away by some kind of judicial activity that is oppressive. He's cut off, but he's cut off for the transgression of my people. Clearly, the prophet is speaking. And so my people would be either God's people generically or Israel in particular, that this one is cut off out of the land of the living. The people who deserve to die are my people. His grave was assigned with wicked men, yet he was with a rich man in his death because he had done no violence, nor was there any deceit in his mouth. This is a very interesting passage here in the Hebrew. I've given you a literal translation of it. Most of your English translations aren't quite this literal. It's, his grave was assigned with wicked men, plural, no definite article, yet he was with a rich man, singular, no definite article, in his death because he had done no violence. The KJV, NIV, etc. often obscure that a little bit, but the explicit thing is, he was intended to be buried with wicked men, but in fact he winds up with a rich man. Doesn't explain how it works. Looking at Jesus' career, we can see how it works, but the passage doesn't explain how it works, but it fits it. He winds up with a rich man in his death because he had done no violence, nor was there any deceit in his mouth. Because of his righteousness, he winds up with a rich man in his death. That could be read either two ways. Either God, because this person is righteous, sees to it that in his burial he is not dishonored, even though in his death he is dishonored. The other might be that this very rich man offers to have him with him in his death because he realized there was no violence nor any deceit in his mouth. Both of those work very well with Jesus. But the Lord was pleased to crush him, putting him in death. If he would render himself as a guilt offering, he will see his offspring, he will prolong his days. God put him to death, and that comes up again and again and again in this passage, a long passage. This person offers himself as a guilt offering, so it's a human sacrifice as a guilt offering from the perspective of the person who is dying, not obviously from the perspective of the people who are oppressing him and putting him to death. I would presume to also see from the perspective of the Lord who is doing this. And yet when he does this, when he dies, he will see his offspring. He will prolong his days. Next verse goes on, said something about he will see the light. And the Qumran manuscripts, the light of life suggests there. But we'll stop it at this particular point. The whole context is an impressive picture of the servant Messiah, and as I said, the climax of the suffering servant passages, or the servant passages that start in Isaiah 40. Put to death by oppression and judgment, death a substitute for ours, burial with a rich man instead of the wicked as planned, brought back to life after becoming a guilt offering. Very impressive at a distance of, even if you read this as second Isaiah, as the liberals do, from a distance of over 400 years, fitting Jesus very well. It's very interesting that this one passage the Jewish synagogue does not read publicly. Many, many Jews are surprised to hear this passage, and when they hear it read, they usually are quite certain it's in the New Testament and not in their Bible. But it's not. It's in their Bible. And we have manuscripts of it from before the event was fulfilled. The two Qumran Isaiah manuscripts predate the fulfillment of it. Now, Nostradamus is very hard to catch in an error because of the obscure language which he uses. But in the preface to his centuries, he bombs very, very badly. from the time I am writing this, he says, and the preface is dated March 1, 1555, before 177 years, 3 months and 11 days, by pestilence, long famine, and wars, and more still by inundations, the world between this day and that, before and after, shall be diminished, and its population so reduced that there will be hardly hands enough to attend to agriculture, and the lands will be left as long without culture as they have been under tillage. That says something very specific is going to happen within 177 and a quarter or so years from March 1, 1555, and that is a series of disasters are going to make the land, and whether you take that to be the, it says the world, excuse me, not the land, the world, that's pretty strong, will be so diminished, its population so reduced, that it basically agriculture will cease for as long as it has been running. Well, agriculture has been running for some thousands of years by Nostradamus' time, and is now going to end for some thousands of years. Well, let's do a little calculation. Here we are, day one of month three of the year 1555, at 11 days, 3 months, and 177 years, and you get 12 June 1732. If you make some minor adjustments for the change in the calendar between the two dates, you still don't get anything big deal, maybe 20th of June or something of that sort, a little bigger than that, maybe 22, 23 June. It didn't happen. That's what it comes down to. It didn't happen. Drastic conditions, specific and long-lasting, nothing of the sort occurred. So Nostradamus certainly bombed on that one. A fourth example from Scripture, Isaiah 11:11. Then it will happen on that day that the Lord will again recover the second time with his hand the remnant of his people who will remain from Assyria, Egypt, Pathros, Cush, Elam, Shinar, Hamat, and from the islands of the sea. A statement about the regathering of the Israelites to their own land. There's going to be a second recovery. Question would be second relative to what? And then a statement of where it's going to come from and a group of specific locations, along with the fairly vague statement, islands of the sea. There can be some argument on what the second regathering is. I take it as probably being that the first regathering was returned from Babylonian captivity, and the second one was after that. That is obviously arguable, but is at least a reasonable suggestion on that particular point. Name seven specific areas in a general area. If we try to convert those to modern locations, Assyria would fairly closely correspond to Iraq and modern Syria. Egypt would correspond to Egypt, though Egypt today is bigger than that, so Pathros would also correspond to part of Egypt. And Cush would correspond to Sudan. And Elam would correspond to Iran. And Shinar would correspond to Iraq. And Hamat would correspond to Syria, so you can at least begin to see some pattern here. It is nations in the Middle East, and all of those actually turn out at this century to be Islamic nations in one way or another. Iraq, Syria, Egypt, Sudan, Iran, and Syria. And the islands of the sea is the other one, and the sea is typically in the Old Testament the Mediterranean, so presumably it would be Europe on the north side. The phrase, by the way, islands, actually islands are coastlands, and North Africa on the south side. What is interesting is that these are just the areas which have experienced large changes in Jewish population in our own generation since the 40s. The threat of Hitler and then the aftermath of World War II and the more rigid stand which Islam began to take against the Jews after the Jews began to come back into Palestine in this century have led to a large exodus of the Jews from Europe at the middle and end, or even the beginning, middle and end of World War II, and then from the Islamic lands since 1948. One of our students did a paper on this particular passage for a elective course we had in Fulfilled Prophecy here some years ago, and she basically dug up the material out of the Encyclopedia Judaica on the population patterns, and at that time showed that all of these territories had had a huge drop in Jewish population either before 1948 out of Europe or since 1948 out of the Islamic countries, with one exception at the time she did the paper, and that was Iran. Iran was still under the Shah at that time, and the Jews were treated rather well then. Since then, Khomeini's arising and such, Jews have pretty well cleared out of Iran as well. So you really do have a very striking way in which those areas have been depopulated of Jews in that time, and many of those have gone back to Israel. Not all of them. Some have come to the U.S. and such. Well, let's try to pull this together. We've looked at 4 and 4. No way I can guarantee you, without your looking at it yourself, whether these are reasonable, you know, normal samples or such out of the two particular sets of works. You will have to look for yourself to satisfy yourself that this is a fair treatment. I've tried to be fair on the material. I am not aware of any real bombing on fulfilled prophecy in the biblical material. There will be some liberals who will obviously disagree with that. We have one very clear example in Nostradamus. Both do give examples of successful prediction, although my experience has been that Nostradamus, most of the time, you cannot get the four quatrains to all work rather nicely and point to anything very significant in what is going on. Both, of course, predict events that have not yet happened, and time will tell where those particular things will go. For instance, Nostradamus has a rather striking prediction on 1999, of I'll have to dig out the thing for you because I can't remember the exact wording of it right now. Nostradamus is clearly missed, obscure as he is. Were it not for that preface, it would probably be impossible to prove that he is missed because the other stuff is so riddling. The Bible has not, though it is much clearer than the Nostradamus material. Biblical predictions are straightforward. Nostradamus is mostly riddles. Difficult to guess what Nostradamus' fulfillment will look like in advance. We tried to do a little of that with the passages we looked at, and the only one that seemed pretty clear in advance turned out to bomb rather badly. Biblical predictions are intended to validate its message. What's the purpose of Nostradamus' predictions? One might suggest it is intended to validate a couple of remarks at the beginning of his centuries which sound occult. In practice, that has been what has happened with Nostradamus. When you present material on fulfilled prophecy to someone who is in the occult or is a New Ager of one sort or another, they will almost invariably point to Nostradamus as a counterexample and suggest that this shows I don't really need to pay attention to the message of the Bible. Nostradamus doesn't have much in the way of a message, but there's certainly this thing that one should think about, and that is, if you're going to commit your destiny to a prophet, would you rather commit your destiny to one who is clear or one who is always riddling? Do you want to find out when it's too late that you misunderstood what the prophet had to say? Okay.